Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're beginning our Shocktober.
Shocktober!
Where we're going to be primarily focusing on movies, as it is all movies, strangely enough, of a sort of horror vibe.
Yes. Yeah, something spooky to get you in the mood as the weather gets a little crisper and the spirits start to move a little more freely as we return to normal time instead of that fake daylight savings business.
And yeah, we're going to do three things, all which have to do with Star Trek creators in some way or another. And first up this week is Twilight Zone, the movie.
Yeah.
But before we get into that, let's get into, I guess, what you could call news to some degree.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah.
Sort of news.
Okay, Kemp Powers is on the writing staff of the new show Star Trek Discovery. And as we discussed in our very first episode, he's probably more so than anyone the person that people don't know anything about. Because even though he is, you know, rather prolific in other media, he hasn't really done anything in terms of television or movies. You know, he was a journalist, he's written a book, he's written a number of plays. And and another thing that he does is this kind of like, I don't know what you would call it, storytelling.
Yeah, it's a story. I have a friend who does this, very talented guy named Dustin. And it's like his group is called Better Said Than Done or something like that. And it's not stand up. Okay. No. Like people mistake it for stand up, but it is. It's people getting up and telling, you know, brief stories from their lives, relaying important events or realizations that they've had about, you know, something that defines them or some sort of insight that they'd like to share with the audience. And it's just literally somebody standing up and telling a story about their life or what have you. It's really cool stuff.
Yeah, and this one is called The Moth, which I guess is pretty popular, all things considered. There's live shows, there's books, and there's also a radio show, which is on, I'm guessing, NPR pretty much across the country. I don't know. It's on NPR here in Chicago, WBEZ. And on the last episode, which aired about a week ago, there is a story which Kemp Powers himself tells. And we listened to it. It's on their website, or you can get it on iTunes or anything like that. But yeah, so I mean, do you want to give a sort of a brief description?
Yeah,
of what
sure,
it is?
Sure. Well, I mean, I do think people should go and listen to it. I mean, it's like 13-14 minutes of your time to listen to Kemp Powers relay this story, and I won't do it justice by giving it a synopsis. It's very compelling. He basically relays a story about coming to terms with the fact that his son is growing up in a very different environment than he did, and he takes you on a journey of his challenge in reconciling what he knew to be the real world versus what his son is experiencing as the real world, and understanding that it's okay for it to have been different. And it's, I think it's a really moving story, and he tells it really, really well. And I think he paints a really good picture of what it was like to grow up where he grew up. So I mean, that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where, I don't know, when I found out that this was going to be on the radio, I got really excited, and I, you know, set the alarm on my phone so that I could listen to it, like, on the radio, which is just a weird, you know, like, I'm like, where, do I have a radio? How do I do this? I don't know how this works. But, you know, I really, really wanted to hear this story because we haven't seen any of his stuff. We haven't heard any of his stuff. And I know that other people have, but we personally have not. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we kind of pride ourselves on knowing who these people are. And, you know, here's someone who we knew absolutely nothing about. You know, we haven't seen his play One Night in Miami, which, by the way, is opening up in London like this month. So if you're in London, I mean, I don't know.
If you have access to London in some way, if you're across the pond, please go see it. And then if you would, let us know what you thought.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been reading about it and stuff, and I'm desperate to see this thing, but I don't have the opportunity. But if I was in London, oh my God, I'd be there opening night. Anyway, so this is like the first exposure that we've had to Powers as a storyteller, and it's exciting. It's really exciting to, you know, kind of like hear this new voice to us anyway. And it's really freaking good, you know?
Yeah, it is.
And it's funny, it's touching, it's everything you could possibly want. It really, in a lot of ways, does what Star Trek does, which is sort of like impart a life lesson through an entertaining medium, you know?
Yeah. The perspective he's going to bring is going to be great. And it just comes out of him to relay these stories. And listening to it, I can't wait to see what he does with Star Trek. I really can't.
Yeah, me either. You know, it's exciting. And I it really makes me want to seek out all of his other stuff, because it's a fascinating story, even if it is, you know, just a little 15-minute thing. People should definitely go and listen to it, and I hope everyone does. I mean, telling stories is telling stories, you know, no matter what the medium is, and he's really freaking good at it. And yeah, definitely check it out. The name of the show, which, you know, will be a podcast, I guess, is The Moth Radio Hour. And it should be on iTunes by the time that you're hearing this. It would be the most recent episode. I don't know the name of it because it's not up on their website yet. But yeah. Be sure to check it out, because
we've given you as many clues as we possibly can. We trust you, our audience, to be intelligent enough to find it.
There you go. There you go. All right. Well, should we move on to our feature for today?
Oh, I'd really love to, Mike.
Okay. Twilight Zone, the movie. Yes. Now, okay. For those people who don't know, Twilight Zone, the movie, came out in, was it 1983, I believe?
83, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was an anthology movie, which had one original story by John Landis and three remakes of episodes of The Twilight Zone. And each segment was directed by a different person. So Landis did the first one. Then we had Kick the Can, which was directed by Steven Spielberg. It's a Good Life, which was directed by Joe Dante. And Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, which was directed by George Miller. And the original episodes were all written by Star Trek creators. And the screenplay for the three remakes were also written by a Star Trek creator. So we thought that this would be a good movie to talk about.
You've got our connective tissue right there.
So I guess before we get into the stories themselves, I mean, it's interesting that they chose to do remakes, right? And there have been a number of incarnations of the Twilight Zone. And I find it fascinating because the Twilight Zone is such a malleable universe that I feel like you can have an original and a remake, and they're both part of the Twilight Zone. They're both part of the same thing. And like even like with It's a Good Life, it was remade here, and then in the Ira Stephen Bear series from the aughts, they did a sequel to it. But at the same time, they also did remakes for a couple of the other episodes. And it all, to me, fits in the same thing, right?
Sure.
But
I mean, the Twilight Zone is basically multiverse theory.
Yeah. Yeah. And you got the 80s series, you got this. But now here's my question, right? I've got two questions here. I always need to bring this up because I...
Oh, no.
Okay. So the nature of the show, a lot of episodes were based on short stories by people. And a couple of those were short stories by Richard Matheson. One of them being Steel, about the robot boxer. And the other one being The Box from the 80s series, right?
Mm-hmm. Which, yes, left scars on me.
Now, tell you that. Now, since both of those were short stories based on, you know, previously published work or whatever, those short stories were later adapted into feature films themselves. So there is a movie version of The Box by Richard Kelly, and there's a movie version of Steel called Real Steel. Which
I saw in the movie theater.
I did too.
Yes.
It
was a thing that happened.
It totally did. I was there. I saw it.
Yep.
It happened. And my first question is, do those remakes take place in the Twilight Zone?
Okay, so this is your basic Mike Schindler continuity.
This is just the warm-up.
Sort of question.
This is just
the warm-up?
Yeah.
I'm going to say yes.
Okay.
Because why not? If we've postulated up to this point that we have the different series, and the different series had different incarnations of the same stories, but it all occurred within the Twilight Zone, then yes. I'm going to say definitively that those both exist within Twilight Zone continuity. Yes.
Okay, I'm going to agree with that. So now here's my second question, right?
Okay.
Now, as you may or may not know, there is, or depending on when you listen to it, was a ride at Disney World and Disneyland called the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, there was, is, and soon will be was.
Yes. So Disney being Disney, always looking for an opportunity to cash in on, tie-in products and whatnot, at one point made a television movie starring Steve Guttenberg and Kirsten Dunst.
That's right. That's right. They did.
Called Tower of Terror.
Yeah.
Now, it's not Twilight Zone Tower of Terror. It's just Tower of Terror.
Mm-hmm.
But since it's based on a ride, which is based on the Twilight Zone, does the Steve Guttenberg, Kirsten Dunst Tower of Terror TV movie, Disney TV movie, take place in the Twilight Zone?
I'm going to have to say yes, but only because Steve Guttenberg is in it, who I believe is from the Twilight Zone.
Okay.
Therefore, he brings it into continuity.
Okay. All right.
Let me go on record with the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror ride. I know they're going to, it's Guardians of the Galaxy, right? That's what they're going to like remake it as or
in
something
fact,
like that.
Just today they released like pictures of like the model for the version that it's like the collector's tower or something.
Boo. Yeah. I say big time boo.
Yeah.
Because I look, change happens, whatever. And I know you can't hold on to everything, but like Twilight Zone Tower of Terror, that feels like something that is so, it was an in to tell my kids about the Twilight Zone and get them interested in watching it. Like, I get it. That's not your cash cow, but you know, I don't know. I think it's a shame that something that's truly dedicated only to the idea of scariness and thrilling you is going to be taken away. That's a shame.
I agree. And I've been to Disney World a billion times. I got married at Disney World. I've never been on the Tower of Terror.
What?
Because I'm scared. You hear the screams?
No, no, no. I demand that you go to the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror.
Okay.
I'm going to drag you on there if I have to.
Well, I'll be back there next month, most likely, because I'll be at a wedding. And
you had better go, Mike. You had better go.
I do have wedding pictures taken in the lobby of the Tower of Terror. It looks amazing. You know?
But it's a wonderful ride. It's not half as scary as you think it is.
How would you compare it to Splash Mountain?
Oh, way better than Splash Mountain.
No, okay, but when you say way better than Splash Mountain, do you mean way scarier than Splash Mountain?
I mean that after the first drop that you get through, I was laughing like a hyena through the rest of the ride because I was having so much fun. It's just, it's that whole free fall and catch and move and messing with your head sort of thing. And you know what they're doing to you, but you just buy into it. And you just have a great time on the ride. Like, it's so cool. It's so much fun because the screams that you hear are typically from younger members of the audience.
Okay.
Because they, do you want me to spoil it for you?
No.
Would it help you prepare?
I mean, you could tell me about it dropping or not dropping or whatever.
It drops.
Yeah.
It drops, but it does. Like, it's one of those ones where it surprises you with how it drops. And it just messes with the fact that, like, you are trapped, quote unquote, trapped in an elevator, you know, that's out of control. Like, it's so much fun.
Okay.
So much fun.
All right. All right. All right. I'll try it. I'll try it.
You have to.
Okay.
I'll try it.
I'll
do
try
it for me.
Sure.
Do it for the audience.
Okay. 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 I'll do it right. And then I'll come back and talk about it if I survive. So,
jeez.
Okay. So on to this movie now. Now that we've got all that out of the way. Okay.
Okay.
So yeah, do we want to talk about the first sequence since it doesn't really have anything to do with that or not?
No, because I don't. I think that the first sequence is one of the moments of the movie that's real. It's got that real sense of delightful fun to it. I don't think if you haven't seen I wouldn't want to blow it.
I meant like the first segment.
Oh, okay.
Which right. you're talking about the delightful first fun. I'm like, wait, what?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm talking about the prologue.
Okay.
Not
yes,
the
yes.
first story.
Yes.
No.
The,
no. No.
The car ride. Yes.
Oh God.
The Albert Brooks Stan Aykroyd sequence. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Good.
No. The first actual story is your morality play about a guy who is a loathsome racist who winds up, thanks to the Twilight Zone, traveling through time, experiencing what it's like to be the people that he said those things about.
Yeah.
And see what they went through and get an appreciation for their life experience, which is a very Twilight Zone-y sort of thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the original story, and it's interesting because it does, in a lot of ways, feel like the most like an original series episode, even though the other ones were based on original series episodes.
Completely agree. It's completely
weird.
Agree.
Yeah.
And, of course, it is the one that they never actually completed the story. The version you get in the film is a truncated version of the story because he was killed. Everybody knows this about the Twilight Zone, that the actor was killed in a stunt that went wrong involving a helicopter. I mean, it's a really, really extremely tragic story. But the thing is, I remember being a kid, the legend that grew up around it was that it was a whole other story that got cut. The fact of the matter is that first story is just a truncated version because the sequence that they shot is where he died, and so they sort of rewrote it on the fly. The legend growing up was that it was an entire story that would never be shown to the world because somebody had died filming it, and so there was all of this mystique around the movie.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's weird. I mean, like reading about the history of the movie and the accident and everything like that, you know, and just thinking about it, like, in the context of movies, you know, today and everything, like, if that happened today, I cannot imagine that this movie would have ever even finished filming, let alone ever been released.
Would have been shut down. Heartbeat.
Yeah.
I completely agree with you. There's no way they would have. Although, what about The Crow? The Crow kept going after Brandon Lee got shot on set and died.
I guess so. But the other thing to think about is that twice as much time has passed since The Crow was made than had passed between Twilight Zone and The Crow. In other words,
wow.
We're old.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm writing down right now that I need to apply for Medicaid after we're done recording here. Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. You know. So I'm here.
No, okay. That's a fair point. I, you know, wow. Has it been that long?
It has.
It really has.
It has.
Yeah. No, it is sort of stunning because it wasn't just that a small stunt went wrong. Like, it was a huge set piece went horribly wrong, and it wasn't just the actor who was killed. It was two young children that were killed. Who were hired illegally in a delightful twist.
Yeah.
So, but, I mean, what's on screen it winds up, I mean, it feels unfinished. You know,
see, I don't know. What I had always heard was that this was originally how it was conceived. And basically they decided that the ending wasn't satisfying and that they wanted to shoot a new ending in which the character was redeemed. And that's what they were shooting. And yeah. Then after the accident, they obviously just went back to the original ending. Which
really?
hearing what the plan was for the new ending, to me it actually sounds like this ending is much better and much more Twilight Zone-y, because it's not a, you know, a heroic ending. It's much more of a morality tale, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, though, for me, it feels unfinished in the sense that it doesn't come together well. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, I think Landis probably in the editing booth after everything happened was like, just get this thing finished and get, like, I just found it to be jumpy and not, it wasn't as coherent as it could have been.
Yeah. It's not very good, you know? And yeah. And I don't know, maybe part of it is just that, you know, sort of like knowing the circumstances, it kind of leaves like a sour taste in your mouth while you're watching it, you know?
Yeah.
Because you can't not think about that while you're watching it.
Now, here's a question that I would ask, because, you know, with the accident, what they have completed today, but in terms of the screenplay, in terms of the language he uses.
Yeah, that was another.
This movie would have been, I mean, I'm like, why isn't, this is sort of R-rated language to have, like. I, you know, you'd walk into this movie and it's like, okay, it might be a little intense for my, oh dear. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Like right out of the gate, they're using language that I would not want my children hearing.
Yeah. And I think it was rated PG. Well, back then there was no PG-13, or it was just about to come into being.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I think this was PG when it was released. And the thing is, we're not talking about just curse words. We're talking about slurs of the worst magnitude.
Yeah.
Being hurled around. And I mean, it's integral to the character and what a loathsome person he is. But at the same time, it's like, you know.
Yeah, it's just like,
a little much.
Not, yeah, yeah. It's crazy. I mean, I guess definitely, you know, it kind of shows the whole thing, you know, kind of shows how different, you know, everything was surrounding movies back in the 80s, you know?
Sure.
It's strange. Sure. It's really strange. But I mean, stuff like this, I think, is also kind of why they have a PG-13 now. Why it was, you know, PG movies were pushing the envelope and everything. And although this I think goes beyond that now. It would definitely be an R, you know, if it were released today.
Oh sure,
no doubt,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So then we have the second one, which is the remake by Steven Spielberg of Kick the Can.
Yes. Now, the original episode was written by George Clayton Johnson, who we just talked about a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
For his work on Ocean's 11. And, of course, he had written The Man Trap for the original series. And this episode of The Twilight Zone was before the original series came out. And, all of these other ones were written by Richard Matheson. Although the credits on Kick the Can are interesting because it shows that the screenplay was written by George Clayton Johnson and Richard Matheson. And even though she took her name off the movie, Melissa Matheson, the writer of E.T.
Yeah.
Okay. This is the episode where basically the people at the retirement home decide that in order to regain their youth, they're going to sort of adopt their childish ways in terms of like playing games and whatnot. And they play Kick the Can and become children.
Yes.
Now, okay, what did you how do you think this compares to the original episode?
The original episode is far better. The original episode, the inhabitants of the nursing home are actually agents of their own action. There's no, you know, external force played by Scatman Crothers you know, that shows up. And while I was watching it, something suddenly occurred to me was at some point, this was the seed for Amazing Stories, mm-hmm. because it looks and feels like Amazing Stories, which was like, you know, kid friendly Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
You know, it was soft Twilight Zone, and that this very much feels like that. And it's really, it doesn't come together well at the end either. And like, it's trying to have this moral about just being happy with who you are and, you know, not necessarily wanting certain, but it just feels like it's a mess. It really does. I mean, that's my take on it.
Yeah, it doesn't work. I mean, I don't think that the original episode is tremendously great either, but it at least works better. But like, you watch that original episode, it doesn't even have like a Twilight Zone type of anything until like literally the last 5 minutes of the episode.
Yeah.
Which is so weird. But, and even then, it's just like, oh, okay, they turn into kids. You know, but at least there is like some perspective and whatever, and they're talking about some interesting things, whereas here, it really feels very Spielbergian in the sense of, you know, like, you know, the boy who doesn't want to grow up, you know, and that kind of like early Spielberg thing, that the Peter Pan phase of his career, as they talk about in Dawson's Creek all the time. And, you know, it's weird. It's a very strange thing. I mean, one of the things I was talking to my coworker, and I'm like, okay, you've got like 157 episodes of The Twilight Zone or something like that, 5 seasons worth of The Twilight Zone, and you've got to pick 3 stories.
Yeah.
You're going to pick Kick the Can?
Agree.
Like,
yeah, completely agree.
It's so bizarre. It's so bizarre. Now, I had read that originally he was planning on doing The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, but... Yeah. After the accident that occurred with the first segment, he changed his mind and decided to go a different route because it would have involved shooting with kids at night and special effects, which were all these conditions which, you know, led to the accident in the first segment, and he just didn't want to deal with that, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. Monsters Are Due on Maple Street is obviously a much more classic episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
That seems like a much better fit for a movie of this nature, but Kick the Can is just, it's weak sauce. You know what I mean?
It is indeed. And the thing is, it's such a waste of Scatman Crothers.
Yeah.
He was such a good actor. And like the whole time I'm sitting there, I'm like, yeah, Scatman, he's just,
yeah, he doesn't really
okay.
do anything.
Well, yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so the next sequence is It's a Good Life.
Yes.
Which the original, it's based on a short story by Jerome Bixby, who wrote a number of original series episodes, including Mirror, Mirror. And yeah. That episode was written by Rod Serling himself, but the, you know, movie version is by Matheson, and this was directed by Joe Dante. And it stars Kathleen Quinlan, and this is the one about the boy, the little boy who basically has omnipotent powers and is controlling everyone in his town or in his life. And if anyone acts up, he basically kills them. And because of that, it's basically what happens when a spoiled brat has, you know, the power of a god, you know?
Yes.
So how do you think this one compares to the original?
I liked what Dante did. It has Dante flourishes throughout the thing. The way that it's shot is really interesting. The way that certain scenes are lit. I thought that the performances were actually really, really good. But the problem with it is not necessarily Dante's fault. I didn't care for the ending of it, but, you know, hey. But, like, it's not Dante's fault. It's the Simpsons' fault, because the Simpsons on one of their Treehouse of Horrors did a parody of It's a Good Life. I cannot watch any version of it anymore without thinking of Bart as the little boy and what he did in that. And I will say that there is an indulgence in the creatures and the horror factor of this, but the original episode is more terrifying because it was, I don't know, it was shorter. It didn't give you, I mean, it's not that it was shorter. It was the original episode just, I don't know what it is that clicks about it more. But I think that the original episode serves much more as, I think, an allegory for like an Orwellian state that, you know, you're going to think what we tell you to think. And if you think reality is this, we're going to prove you wrong. Like almost like a Stalinist regime sort of thing, which would have been very much on the mind of fantasy writers, you know, coming out of World War II. And so I just think that the one in the movie plays like a monster story, whereas the original one plays like a metaphor, if that makes sense.
I can kind of see that. At the same time, I don't know, like I do think that the original is much better, but when I watch the original, you know, I find it to be extraordinarily terrifying. Like you never see anything, you know, you just hear them like described, you know, and like things are just like slightly off camera or whatever. And like the thing at the beginning of it, like, what's that you got there? What's that creature? And he's like, oh, it's, you know, a three-headed gopher, but I don't like it anymore, so I'm going to make it dead. You know, things like that. And it's just like, oh my God, like it freaks me out. It really, really freaks me out. And there's just something which is so evil there that it's very, very unsettling. Like it's the stuff of nightmares.
Yep.
And the version in the movie I thought was just sort of bizarre and all over the place and had this really, really weird sense of humor and everything. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like a cartoon, even though that's obviously something that they were playing with, but like beyond that, like the non cartoony elements felt cartoony, and it sort of really took me out of the movie in a sense and did not scare me at all. It just felt bizarre. I thought like mm-hmm. a lot of the choices that they were making were not effective. So I don't know.
I think that's fair criticism. I think that the ending also is just weird to end on such a that is another key difference is with the original episode. First and foremost, like I think the scene in that one that makes it so terrifying is the guy that, you know, the little boy looks at him and he's about to send him, you know, he's about to punish him. And the guy's screaming. He's like, fine, he's going to take me out. What are you? He's paying attention to me. Kill him, for God's sake. Here's your chance.
Yeah.
And nobody does anything. And the guy, like, it's that moment where the guy, you see the true terror where he's like, don't let me die for nothing, please. Like, whereas the way that they kill the girl in this is, you know, having her being eaten by a cartoon is,
mm-hmm.
like you said, it's just quirky for the sake of quirky. And I keep coming back to the ending. I don't like the ending at all.
Yeah.
I
don't know. In a sense, I find it to be kind of creepy because I feel like she's almost so fascinated with him that she's like turning to the dark side in a sense too. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of interesting, but I don't think it works nearly as well.
Nah.
I don't know. Now, I will say, you know, if you haven't seen it or if anyone hasn't seen it, you know, when Ira Stephen Baer did his Twilight Zone show in the aughts, they did do a sequel to this episode, and Baer wrote it himself. And the idea is basically they got Bill Mumy, who played the kid in the original, to come back and reprise his role. And basically the idea is that he has a kid now. Now he has a little girl who also has this power. So it's like returning to that universe, you know, 40 years later. And it's really pretty interesting. So definitely, definitely check that out. Okay, so this brings us to our final adventure Nightmare at 20,000 feet.
Which, even though it occurs at 35,000 in this one.
Is it Nightmare at 35,000 in this one?
No, I don't think that they changed the title, but they say at one point that they're cruising at 35,000 feet.
Oh, I thought they did change the title. I don't know. Anyway.
I always thought they were just called Segment.
Oh, like whatever, Segment One. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right. This one is, you know, also written by Matheson, but it's unique in that he wrote the original series episode as well. So he's adapting himself. Yes. And what should be noted about the original is that it starred William Shatner.
Yep.
And also was directed by Richard Donner.
Yep.
The director of Superman and
various and Lethal Weapon.
And The Omen. And
oh, that's right. And The Omen, yeah. Which was covered on Commentary Trek Stars.
Yeah. Yeah. So the remake is by George Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And it stars John Lithgow, although something that I read online said that originally they wanted William Shatner to come back and reprise his role here.
I could see that.
That would have been so awesome. But
yeah, it would.
They got John Lithgow instead. And this is, of course, the episode or the segment where the Lithgow is a passenger on this plane who is, he's not a big fan of flying. And as he looks out the window, he sees a monster on the wing of the plane, and he's the only one who sees it, and no one believes him, and he needs to try to stop this monster before the plane crashes.
Yes.
While everyone on board thinks he's crazy.
Yes.
So what did you think about this segment and how it compares?
This is how you remake something. I mean, not surprising because it's George Miller, but like they took everything about it that was more prim and proper and, you know, slow burn about the original, and they said, no, we're going to make him very obviously uncomfortable with flying to begin with, and then just continue ratcheting the tension up as it goes along. I adore this segment. I think it's great. I think it's exactly how the rest of the movie should have gone. How George Miller shows up Steven Spielberg in a Steven Spielberg production blows my mind. And I can also say that... this is kind of what it's like flying with me. So I've never seen a creature on the wing of the plane, but if there's somebody who's going to see it, it's this guy right here. So,
yeah, you know, I think that this is definitely the best segment of the four. But I still prefer the original because, I mean, part of it is Shatner's performance. And this is something which I think we brought up when we were doing our series on Matheson. You know, Matheson wrote The Enemy Within, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a great episode of the original series for Shatner in particular, because you've got, you know, evil Kirk and good Kirk, right? And they're split, and you get to see Shatner really ham it up on both sides of that equation. And then you've got Nightmare at 20,000 Feet and everything like that. And something which, you know, I kind of thought about while watching those, you know, back then is like Richard Matheson, whether by design or I don't even think it's by design. I think it's just, you know, sort of like this natural thing that happens. Like Matheson's writing and Shatner's acting go hand in hand so well. There's something about the way that Matheson writes where you can just see Shatner reading those lines. Like I remember thinking that while I was reading I Am Legend, like the Matheson's book, and like the way that it's written, I could totally see, you know, 60s era Shatner playing the lead in that, you know?
Sure.
And I don't know. I mean, because of that, you know, just because of the script along with the performance and the way that they work together, I absolutely love the original. And I love how it is like more subdued and sort of played straight in a sense. Whereas from frame one of the remake, it's like, oh my God. I mean, like literally frame one is John Lithgow in the bathroom with like, I think they shot with an anamorphic lens, which was stretched in the other direction. So the picture's all distorted and he's just like, ah, this is the worst day of my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, very...
He's hiding in the bathroom while a storm rocks the plane.
Right.
I'm not saying I haven't or have been in that situation.
And I think just because of Lithgow's performance in this and the way that it is shot and edited and everything, it is, you know, definitely, you know, kicked up to 11, you know?
Yeah, but that's the thing. Is like, I agree with you. I agree the original one's terrific and wonderful. I take nothing away from it. But Miller did what you would hope. Like, if you're going to remake three episodes, go for broke. Make it yours. And Miller's the only one in this entire movie that makes it his.
Yeah, I would say Spielberg made it his and kicked the can as well. I just think that
not in a good way.
No, not in a good way. Yeah,
I mean, make it yours in a good way. Yeah. And I mean, Dante made it his, but again.
Yeah, not in a good way. Yeah, I agree. But I think if you were to ask me which was better, I would definitely pick the original for that one as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do think
two sides of the same coin.
I do think it is, you know, the best of the four segments in the movie. And I also think that it's interesting to see for sure, you know. I like the fact that I mean, if he had done just like a shot for shot remake, you know, I think it would have been sort of a waste of Miller, like you're saying, you know.
Yeah.
So I definitely think it's an interesting take on the material.
But I will say that the prologue is also up there for entertainment value.
Yeah.
I
mean,
like, seriously, you walk out of this movie and you love the prologue and you love Miller's part and the rest of it. You take it or leave it.
Yeah. Yeah. The prologue is really good. You know, Albert Brooks and Dan Aykroyd just sort of going to town. It's pretty great. You know?
But see, what's interesting, and just as a quick final note, is like there were other anthology movies that tried to follow suit with like Tales from the Dark Side, mm-hmm. And stuff like that, that, you know, in the 80s that tried to follow suit, and none of them ever seemed to work well. I mean, you got Creepshow 2, which is unintentionally one of the funniest movies I ever watched. The original Creepshow is pretty horrifying at points. You know, Tales from the Dark Side, which had like a... Was that the one that had Steve Buscemi in it?
I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Lot 239. Anyway, I'll look it up. But I went to see all of these things. I was in line for anything that was a horror movie. And these anthology movies, it's so weird how hard it is for them to work. It's the same story every time, where there's one segment where you walk out and you're like, that one was great, and the rest of it was there.
Yeah, and that seems to be something which happens a lot with anthology movies in general, like New York Stories, you know. Mm. I mean, the Scorsese segment is amazing, and the other two are completely forgettable, you know. Or Four Rooms, you know, there's like two really good segments and two which are just kind of okay, you know. It's strange.
What do you think it is that makes it so hard? Is it just the fact that film requires a single directing mind, whether it's two brothers or one person directing it? Or, like, is it just some people just aren't suited for a short film format?
I think it's just like with anything. I mean, like, you take, you know, these four directors, you know, Landis, Spielberg, Dante, and Miller, right? Yeah. And you say, like, let's say they all have a movie coming out in the span of a year, you know? I mean, let's just take a look at, you know, I was going to say each of their last movies, but I can't even remember what the last movie Landis or Dante made. But, you know, I mean, some of them are going to be good and some of them are going to be bad, you know? And
fair point.
And it's just, you know, one of those things. And it's like, well, each of them are, you know, doing the Twilight Zone. And if you were to tell me any of them are making a Twilight Zone movie, I'd be like, yeah, I'm there. But, you know, some of them are not going to be good. And that's just the way it works, you know?
Fair point.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, well. And anything else you have to add? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's like we're sitting here sort of beaten up on it. I would be interested to hear anybody else's take on it. Like, what you know, did this make an impression on anybody? You know, those of you that are renting and watching it, who are, you know, watching it because we're talking about it, I'd love to hear what impressions other people get.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been actually going through and watching The Twilight Zone for the past, like, couple of years now. I guess it's taken me a while, but I just finished season 2. And it's kind of interesting after seeing, you know, all of those original episodes to then kind of like see this incarnation, you know, with sort of all of that in mind. And I like the idea that this exists. I like the idea that there are different eras of the Twilight Zone and that it is all sort of like the same thing, the same multiverse, you know, as you were saying. And, you know, I like the Ira Stephen Bear show, and I can't wait to see, you know, whatever comes next. You know, I guess they're talking about doing a movie, which is not an anthology, which seems really weird. Like, what is
that? Oh, wasn't, Tron Legacy, wasn't he? Yeah. Joseph Kosinski, wasn't he attached to it?
Yeah, yeah, I don't think he is anymore, but yeah.
Oh.
But yeah, I mean, I can't wait to see whatever comes next for the Twilight Zone, and I like seeing how the Twilight Zone means different things in different eras, you know, very similarly to Star Trek. And so I'm glad that this exists, even though I don't think it's very good, you know.
Yeah, I mean, out of five, it's probably a two.
Yeah, I'd probably say the same thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's interesting nonetheless, for sure.
Very true.
All right, well, it's been fun talking about the Twilight Zone movie today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
You know, Pushing Daisies and Hannibal are two very different shows, but they both have a very strong visual look and a very strong storytelling style and a point of view. And one is quirky, and one is darkly quirky, and one is whimsically quirky.
Standard Orbit.
Just across the board, it gives you space adventure, because they go to the galactic barrier. It gives you the personal dilemma, which is what Star Trek's all about, exploring the human condition. And it gives you just a fun action adventure as well. So just great entertainment.
The 602 Club.
With the idea of putting your faith in a lie, what do you put your faith in, and is it strong enough to hold it? What they're asking Gotham to put their faith in is a lie. And the moment, again, it comes out, it's not going to be good. And that always struck me as something that's going to be really interesting.
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions. And that's what the 70s were about, was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's iTunes or Stitcher or TuneIn or wherever. So check us out. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That really does help us out and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show when they search iTunes. We have to thank our associate producers today, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for your support. We couldn't do it without you. And if you want to be like Chris, Jeff, and Norm, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And you can donate to the network. And, you know, we really appreciate whatever you can help us out with. If you go there, you'll find different contribution levels along with the perks that we have for you. So go over there, patreon.com/trekfm. And donate. If you want to contact us, you can find the network on Twitter at Trek FM, and you can also find the network on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. Facebook is also where you'll find our listener forum, The Babel Conference. Just type The Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for Kessel Junkie, that's who I am on all the social networks. You can also find me over on Aggressive Negotiations, the Star Wars podcast with Matthew Rushing on the Nerd Party Network. And you can find me with Craig Sorrell over on Words with Nerds, which is a general interest geek show. So, Mike, where can people discover you online?
You can discover me right here on Trek FM, producing From There to Here, which is our daily show where we rewatch all 729 episodes of Star Trek over the span of the year for the 50th anniversary. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. Well, that's it for our the first week of Shocktober. Next week, we will continue our journey into the macabre, or whatever you want to call it.
Macabre.
Right. With Green Room, the new movie starring Anton Yelchin and Sir Patrick Stewart.